Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this episode of City Talks. Today, my guest is James Plunkett. James has recently been appointed Group Chief Practices Officer at Nesta. He was previously at Citizens Advice. He's also the author of an excellent book called End State, 9 Ways Society is Broken and How We Can Fix It. And the focus of our today's conversation is an essay James has penned for a project with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation looking at social justice in a digital age. And this particular essay, which is one of 3, is entitled Unequality. When inequality changes, our strategies must too. Welcome, James.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the word and the frame and the term inequality. Obviously, it's less familiar than inequality. You're not just making a semantic point, which is great. You're not trying to draw a definition away. You're actually trying to think about how thinking about these terms and the language that we use really does have real world implications. So just unpack inequality for us.
Yeah, I think on inequality, so as kind of traditionally thought about, I think one of the challenges we've got in the debate about inequality is that our language is holding us back, correct? Because a lot of my work is about the implications of the transition to a digital economy. And I think there are some very profound changes underway as part of that transition, one of which is to the nature of inequality and how inequality behaves, how it manifests in our society and economy, and therefore the strategies that we need to use to tackle inequality. And it seems to me that almost because we're using the same old word, that sort of smuggles in the same old assumptions. And so in this essay, the more I wrote it, the more I thought, we need a new word. And so it's a bit of a device. But I use the word inequality just purely to say this is different. This is different from traditional inequality when you look at the way in which it's behaving these days. And then I go about a bit of a quest, I suppose, in the essay to say, well, if we define inequality as the kind of inequality that is manifesting today in this modern contemporary 21st century digital economy, then What are the sort of main characteristics of inequality as distinct from inequality as traditionally conceived in the 20th century?
Yeah, and we'll come on to those. I mean, inequality as a term and obviously as a set of concerns, a set of issues has been around for. Why do you think that the understanding of that hasn't evolved in the way that you would have anticipated, given the real world changes in the way that the economy functions or the way that society functions? Is there something in there that is preventing the evolution of the understanding of what we mean by inequality?
I think this is a really common challenge in public policy in particular. I mean, it's a challenge in all, across life, that our language often doesn't keep pace with the way the world's changing. And I think in public policy in particular, it's more of a challenge because these concepts, these words like inequality, competition, consumer choice, for example, they're sort of almost tethered. It's almost as if they're tethered down by a whole set of constructs. So, there are within inequality, there are statistical constructs like the Gini coefficient. There are institutions. There are ways of thinking about inequality and sort of representing it visually and charting inequality. There's the work the IFS and Resolution Foundation does whenever there's a budget on what are the effects of this budget on inequality. And so it's almost as if we've sort of built all of these constructs around a word like inequality, or in the case of other areas of public policy, around a concept like competition or consumer choice. And so it makes it quite hard for that word to evolve and to keep up. And so I talk in the essay about this concept that I've called semantic drag, which is this sense that the world changes and our language doesn't. And I think, as I say, that's a problem in general with language, but it's more of a problem, I think, in these sort of, when we're using language in a sort of professionalized context like public policy, as we are with inequality.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to the shape of inequality, as you understand. So your definition that you lay out which is very succinct and very, which is excellent, is the salient economic injustices that arise from capitalism in its early to mid 21st century form. So that's a kind of nice encapsulation of it. But then to start us to understand what's actually happening underneath that, or how capitalism, as we currently understand it, has evolved over the last few decades. You talk about, you ask us to imagine two societies and the way the distribution of activity is between them. Just say a little bit about that, because I thought that was it's a really neat way of getting to the heart in some respects of how we should think about these two, you know, how capitalism is evolving.
Yeah, so it's one of the really interesting things that's changed, I think, and that makes inequality different from inequality as it was in the 20th century is the distribution of wages within and between firms. And so I give this, as you said, I in the essay, I talk about two societies. One, you know, if you imagine two societies that have the same level, if you like, of say the Gini coefficient or the 90-10 ratio, the kind of, you know, the normal statistics we'd use to measure phenomenon like the distribution of wages. But in one society, wages vary widely within firms. So you'll have, you know, the boss earns more than the manager, who earns more than the cleaner within the firm. In the second society, wages vary more between firms. And so you'll have a very low paying firm, and then you'll have a very high paying firm. And what's happened in the last 20 years, when you look at the data, is that we've moved from the first of those to the second. So in, if you like, sort of 20th century inequality, as we used to understand it, it was this sense in which everyone drifted apart from everyone else. This was the 1980s style of inequality, where, you know, the boss down the hallway would get a big pay rise, the manager would get a moderate pay rise, the cleaner would get a smaller pay rise. And so you saw this sort of drifting apart within companies, right, within the organizations that we worked in. And one thing that's quite important about that is, you know, so people's pay was drifting apart. There's no denying that wage inequality was going up in that time. But to some degree, we shared certain sort of daily experiences, right? And I say in the essay, you might have gone to the Christmas party together, or you shared a chat in the lift. And it's not that felt necessarily nice, because the inequality was there. But nonetheless, you worked in the same company. Today, what we're seeing much more is what people call inter-firm wage inequality, right? So you have these extremely high paying firms, and the kind of emblematic examples would be Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, big tech giants. And then you have these very low paying firms, often outsourced. So cleaning company, for example, because now the cleaners are outsourced. They don't go to the office party anymore. Uber's a really interesting example of this in their own right. You know, Uber drivers extremely highly paid. Uber drivers extremely low paid, Uber coders extremely highly paid. They never meet each other. And so you get this drifting apart of organizations as opposed to people. And although in the statistics you don't see any difference necessarily, so that might have the same Gini coefficient in those two societies, it feels very different, right? It feels really different because we don't share these kind of same day-to-day experience necessarily. And we'll get onto this, I'm sure, but in terms of the spatiality of this and how this maps onto place, these two companies exist in very different parts of the country. They're very geographically different, and people's daily experience working in either a high-paid firm or a very low-paid firm, they're two worlds almost that don't communicate.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then you sort of say, you know, when you look at some of the way that these drivers play out, in a sense, you know, wage gaps are rising because productivity gaps are rising, but also wage gaps have risen more than productivity gaps. And that's in part to do with which type of firm or which firm you're actually working in is quite makes a material difference. I love the quote you say in the essay: Google rolled out a free birthday massage, Ryanair banned its staff from charging their mobile phones, which is a beautiful, I think, encapsulation, I think, in some respects, of the way that different firms operate, but also, I guess, the status and the esteem that they then give to the people that do the work for them, or, you know, or are workers of them. Is that right?
Right. And these trends run deep, right? So the kind of the thing when you dig into the numbers and think, you know, why is this happening? It's because productivity gaps between these firms are rising partly. So these superstar firms, as they sometimes get called, and it comes onto this winner-takes-all economy debate about how competition's functioning. But these very high-performing firms are extremely productive, and the very low-performing firms or the low-paying firms are often laggards when it comes to productivity. But also, as you say, those high-paid workers have more of a negotiating power, because if you're a coder or a UX designer, you can ask for what you like, essentially, in these labor markets, because there's such a shortage of talent. And so these firms are bidding in a sort of bidding war for talent when it comes to Google and Facebook. On the other hand, if you're stuck, there's maybe a local supermarket or a local warehouse that's the only low-paying employer in town, you've got very little negotiating power. And so what you see happening at the same time is both a widening in productivity gaps between firms and a widening in bargaining power. And so high-paying firms don't just make more money, they also give more of that money to their high-paid workers than a low-paying firm would. And as you say, it's definitely not just about money, it's about how it feels, it's about perks, it's about self-esteem and status, which again, it gets into the question of geography and place as well.
Yeah. And you argue, I think, really well in the essay. And Stian Westlake, for example, which I know who's contributed to the series, and talks about the way the economy has changed and what that kind of happens. In a sense, you're saying here that the traits or the trends that we're seeing, they're not bugs of the modern economy. They are features, right? They're it's a logical manifestation of the way that the economy is evolving, and in particular, the increasing growth and significance of what you call the digital economy. Stian would talk about the intangible economy, which is, they're not quite the same, but they're very similar. Just say a little bit about that in a sense, because I think sometimes people think, and you make this critique, oh, these are things that we can just, we can deal with them because they're bugs and we can iron them out. And you're saying it's actually much more fundamental than this. These are, features. They're deeply held features in the modern economy. So tinkering is probably not going to make much difference. Just say a little bit about that, and then we'll go on to, you can say a little bit more about the place aspects.
It flows very directly from the logic of how this economy functions, right? So it's not as you say, it's not a bug, it's a feature. It's so, and Stian has written two excellent books on this, looking at the intangible economy and how it functions. The intangible economy being, shift away from an economy based on tangible things that we make, physical products, to an economy based on intangibles like software, intellectual property, ideas, brands, and so on. One of the things you see in the intangible economy, and this is very related to the question of digital, is these, what they call sort of spillovers or cluster effects, where, if you're a firm, like Google, you have a very powerful brand, you also have incredible data, you also have amazing software, you also have amazing organizational capabilities, all of those things, intangible sources of value, and they magnify each other. So Google's data makes its brand more powerful, and its brand draws in people that gives it more data that makes it more powerful again. And so you get these spiral effects almost, and this speaks to the point about productivity gaps, that these firms at the top pull away. And this runs deep. This is the logic of digital capitalism, right? So, within digital, for example, which is the sort of subset almost of the intangible economy debate, if Google gets more data, that enables them to run a better search engine, which gets them more data, which enables them to run a better search engine. It's similar on a platform like Facebook. If Facebook gets more users, then it becomes a more attractive platform, which gets Facebook more users. And so as people who work in competition policy are seeing, you get these very hard to reverse winner takes all effects. And that's not an accident. That is an essential feature of the way this economy functions. And that is why I think this idea that we need a sort of new way of thinking about inequality, and almost a new word, that's just different to how inequality functioned in an industrial economy in the 20th century. So it's as you say, it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, and I wrote just in that sort of space. You make this point that despite us being told all the time that technology is the great disruptor, or digital is the great disruptor in many respects because of the characteristics of the digital economy. Actually, disruption and competition are reduced rather than increased because of the way that these firms are able to dominate because of the self-reinforcing attributes that are, as you say, scale begets scale and so on and so on. So they kind of lock out competition, which is, again, you know, not an immediate thing that people would typically think about.
Yeah, and this is so interesting. I think this gets into the politics of this, which we maybe come on to later, but the this is not a productive economy. So, and I think this is quite fundamental, because if you think the way we sort of ended up talking about inequality, let's say, you know, in the 80s and 90s, was that there was this implicit trade-off, right? So inequality, yes, you know, we didn't like it on the left, you know, progressives didn't like the unfairness of inequality, but it was dynamic. And there was this implicit sense of, you know, it's almost a kind of necessary evil, right? That, you know, an unequal economy, as in the 80s, was, you know, unfair, but it was fast growing, it was dynamic, there was creative destruction going on, new firms emerging, lots of entrepreneurialism. You know, you can debate how much you buy that, but it was sort of there in the stats to some degree, right? This idea that, you know, that this, the trickle-on idea caught on for a reason, that the 80s were an extremely unequal decade that was relatively dynamic, and there was fairly strong growth in that period, and real incomes grew. If you look now, as you say, this new form of inequality that I'm calling inequality in the essay, obviously productivity has been lagging terribly. Competition, if you look at some of the measures of competition, startup activity, entrepreneurialism, they're falling. Dynamism, so they call these displacement events where a big firm is knocked off its perch and another firm rises to the top. Those are falling because these big firms are extremely hard to knock off their perch. They're not that innovative, these big firms, interestingly, as they never have been throughout history. You know, that the next Google isn't invented by Google. That's not how it works. It comes through in a startup. And one thing that's happening is these big firms are gobbling up all the startups before they can scale. So it's, this old idea that there was a sort of trade-off where you sort of, you know, you kind of sucked up a bit of inequality for some dynamism. We have a very unequal economy that is sclerotic, not very productive, not very competitive, and all these things happening at the same time.
Yeah, no, it's I completely agree with that. And let's get on to the geography. And as you rightly say, this digital economy is not evenly or randomly distributed across space, right? Not in the UK, not in the US, not in France, not in Germany. You know, wherever the digital economy is and it's of a reasonable size, it tends to concentrate into certain places, and actually in many respects, a great number of small places. And I smiled many times reading it, but I smiled very early in the geography section where you rightly give short thrift to the idea of the death of distance. I hear this an awful lot. I'm sure you do, right? You know, it's fine. The internet economy, the digital economy means we can do this anywhere. You know, distance is no longer a prohibitor. Place is no longer important. Not true. And secondly, you always get a hat tip when you mention Alfred Marshall as well. You know, when you take it back and say it's all in Marshall, which is exactly true. But just unpack the geography aspect and say a little bit more about how you think about, you know, the geography of the digital economy. And then I think one of the things that you rightly draw out is the cumulative effect that place becomes this sort of absorbent, sort of has an absorbent quality. And then once you get strong economies, you get a bunch of other things that are going on in that place, whether related to education or health. So just say a little bit about how you think about, you know, or why you think this the particular geography that we're seeing is coming about.
Yeah, it's one of the sort of, in a way, one of the surprises, as you say, of how this has panned out, that people said, you know, if you think back to the sort of 90s, what would the internet do? It would be placeless. It would, you know, I remember these old ideas. You wouldn't have to travel anymore because you'd sit at home and I don't know what.
Everybody would be on their laptop on a beach somewhere and it would all be laptop.
And so, yeah, obviously remote work, and obviously to some, you know, we've seen pandemic, you know, rise in remote work, but you know, I think people are surprised that people by going back to the office more than we thought. So this sort of placelessness of the internet economy has not panned out. And what you see in the data is largely the opposite, right? So very intensely spatially clustered, this new economy. So you see in the US in particular, sort of extreme example of this, where staggering portions of the new patent claims happen within a tiny number of tech clusters. The top 10 tech clusters in America account for 90% of venture capital investment, and they're home to only a quarter of the US population. San Francisco on its own is 2.5% of the US population. That's nearly half, so 48% of all VC investment in San Francisco. So, you know, it is intensely spatially clustered in these quite small, obviously city-based clusters of tech. And obviously where you have the patents and the money and the investment, you then have the high-skilled jobs, and then you get this kind of spiral effect where people then move to those cities, highly educated workers are drawn to those cities for those jobs, and then firms are drawn to those cities to hire those workers. And so far, at least with the pandemic, we have seen an uptick, of course, in remote working. But at the moment, at least, those effects are still very much seeming to be driving that kind of clustering. And we also know, I mean, this is where it goes back to Marshall, that there's a kind of causal reason for that clustering, right? So we know that if someone moves to a big city to live near other people working in their area of expertise, they become more innovative. So they people who move to big cities go on to file more patents. And this is the whole idea of innovation and so on being almost in the air in big cities, that you can sort of, you almost by osmosis, you breathe in because you're just surrounded by people working in your field, that there's an innovativeness that comes from that innovation flows out of these clusters. Yeah. And so it's not that there's a kind of causal relationship going on here as well. And I mean, in a way in the past, you might almost have thought of that as quite a positive story, a dynamic story, people, the classic story of social mobility, that someone moves to the big smoke with a battered suitcase and a dollar in their pocket, and finds a job. Yeah, a big thing that has changed, that has sort of slowed that down, is house prices, because of course, one of the other effects of this clustering, house prices have rocketed, interestingly, in London and San Francisco. When I crunched the numbers, very similar jumps in house prices. Two very successful tech clusters. House prices up about 300% since the year 2000 in both cities. And as I describe it in the essay, it's almost like walls have risen around these castles. And so as the castles have gone kind of climbed higher and become more and more elaborate, walls have risen around them, making that old story of mobility much harder and locking people out. So it's not a story of dynamism again. It's a story of sclerosis and immobility.
Yeah, and I'm going to come back to the point about the innovation aspect in a second. And the obvious point, you will know, the two places you pick, London and San Francisco, incredibly expensive places now to rent or to buy homes. And two places, if I'm being polite, that could probably do better in terms of providing more housing than they currently do. Let me be polite and say it that way rather than a slightly different way. But the other point I wanted to come back on, just to get your thought, because I hear this a lot. Maybe I don't know what you do, James. I hear the way you've described. These cities, they're becoming dominant in the digital economy. They're kind of sucking in these firms, they're sucking in talent, they're sucking in investment, etc. I also get a sense with some, not with all, but with some, that they can't quite understand that there can't be any benefits for these firms and these workers being in these places. And if we, if we stopped these firms going to London or to San Francisco or to Seattle or, wherever it might be, they would magically appear somewhere else. And I think there's a slight disjunction, I think, in the way that people think about or understand why this clustering effect is so incredibly strong and why not many, but still those that can take advantage of it do get quite large advantages as a result of it.
Yeah, there's a whole debate, obviously, about in public policy about, sort of to what extent can you artificially create these clusters? Yeah. And you get these occasional, perpetual kind of debates about this. And often government leans into this and sort of says we're going to create X new, San Francisco's or whatever it might be. I don't know. My read of the literature on that is it is a mysterious it's a mysterious phenomenon. And when you look, I mean, there's kind of some lovely kind of stories about why the existing clusters emerged. And you get all kinds of interesting things. You know, there's this sort of
every cluster has got its own story. Well, I don't know what the current. I can never remember the Tolstoy quote, but whatever it is, it's relevant in the sense that, you know, when you look at these individual clusters, they almost have their own individual story, and it's very hard to generalize. And even if we can generalize, we tend to generalize after the fact rather than beforehand as well.
Right. And there's stories about, you know, Seattle, you know, Bill Gates moved.
Bill Gates wanted to be near his family. Yeah.
Near his family you know, these
Shockley and Fairchild in Silicon Valley and all of these sort of things, that it's very difficult. Or the Romans in London, you know, who knows, right? I mean.
And so it's not to say you can't, I mean, it's not to say you should sort of, like, a fatalism in that is one risk, but it is to say, you know, you can't, you know, the sort of artificial grass kind of approach of saying that, you know, we can artificially create these things is very difficult. And you know, I mean, I'm slightly contentious in the essay, in the sense that I sort of say, in to some extent, you have to sort of accept that London is a centre of, is a cluster, and, you know, build shed loads more housing in it. You know, as you sort of intimated, that doesn't mean you shouldn't go down the levelling up agenda and so on, but to some extent, sort of telling yourself that you can change that. And not, you know, not in a sense running with that and saying, you know, we have to build vast amounts more housing to make London accessible to folk. You know, the stat that stuck with me the most writing this essay is the population of California is shrinking. I mean, you know, we're in the biggest gold rush in history, right, with tech, and that is the center of the gold rush, that is the gold mine, and the population is shrinking because people can't access it, in large part because of house prices. Yeah. So no wonder these jobs, no wonder the wage premiums are so high on these jobs, and workers are in such short supply at some of these companies.
And you see a similar position in London for many decades. Essentially, London's population has been growing, but essentially it's been growing through international migration coming from elsewhere to work and live in London, whilst, you know, those already in the country, already in London, are leaving for other parts of the country, mainly the greater southeast, but they are leaving London. Obviously, you know, international migrants are not typically, you know, they're not typical of your general population, tend to be younger, tend to be single, tend to be more open to sharing, and therefore, you know, having a kind of higher density experience, which is fine and great, but, you know, your city needs to be able to offer, your place needs to be offer more opportunities across the spectrum, rather than you can only come and work here really if you're prepared to, you know, to share home and to be single and to be relatively young. I mean, that's not, or to be, you know, to be incredibly rich, or actually ironically to be pretty poor, right, in the sense that, you know, you get council housing or social housing as well. So I think it is a really good point. Just touch on a little bit around, and then we'll get on to what we might do about all of this. But you also highlight that when you then think about place, it's not just that some places, a few number, are doing incredibly well in relation to the economy. That has knock-on spillover effects onto other aspects that we would care about, social outcomes. Just say a little bit about, you know, about that. And, you know, from my end, this is all about sorting, right? And we're just sorting people across into, and, you know, so just say something about that.
Yeah, I think that this is one of the sort of, the image that sprung to mind in terms of how is inequality different from inequality is, you know, with inequality, I have this phrase that people sort of drifted apart like dust. This is the 80s point, you know, there was a kind of, you know, the richer you were, the better you did, and people drifted apart on a sort of individual level. With inequality, the phrase I use is that it's more like people are congealing into clots. Like, if you imagine sort of fat congealing. And so this is the point about clusters, that we're collecting together into homogeneous organizations. So, you know, high-paid people work with high-paid people, low-paid people with low-paid people, and into places, so high paid places, low paid places. And one of the things, particularly on place, one of the things that does is, I say in the essay that place has a kind of a kind of wicking effect in the sense that it sort of helps injustice cross domains of our lives. So if you have lots of very highly paid, highly educated people living in the same place, then, you know, you see health get better in that place. You get better access to healthy foods in that place. You get better housing, you get better recreational facilities, greener spaces, and so on. And obviously the opposite happens. If talent and wages, jobs leave a place, you end up with, as you get described in the health debate, you know, obesogenic environments, you get food deserts where there's no access to healthy food. And so we've seen one of the most stark and troubling, I think, trends in the last 20 years is this soaring of health inequalities. I mean, it's just staggering now that the gap in life expectancy between a rich place in one of these clusters and a poor place has widened and widened. And so you get this kind of oozing out of the injustice from the economic domain, if you like, into health domains. And I guess from a political point of view, it very quickly becomes a debate about status. And so you get, again, not just high paid and low paid places, but high status places that feel a part of the future, that people feel part of the economy we're building, and low status places. And this is obviously central to the point about populism, the Brexit vote, the kind of cultural divide, is places that feel like they can't see themselves in the future, and this sense of being left behind. So it's a political phenomenon as much as it's an economic one.
Yeah, I think that's a particularly powerful point. We often, as you say, we often think about the material status of places and of people, but actually, I think, as you say, one of the characteristics of the modern economy is that there's risks around esteem, about status, about people feeling unfair or not listened to, and that which has political implications as well as economic implications as well. Let's go on to sort of policy implications. Well, you list out five, which we'll come to and just get you to talk through them in a second. But I want to come back or start with in the policy sense, because you make this point really powerfully that the traditional way of thinking about this, is to see inequality as an outcome from a competitive economy. We have to, we don't like it, but we have to bear it, because in the greater good is served by inequality, and we can deal with it through redistribution. But you also say that it's because we think about equitable issues and efficiency issues, or traditionally we've thought about them as somewhat separate, and you think again that's a sort of category error. So just say a little bit about that, about the framing of policy, and then we'll get into some of the specifics that you've talked about in the essay.
So I think there's a big opportunity here, and I it may not sound like it, but I'm an optimist.
No, you are an optimist, and I was going to say The End State is a very optimistic book. You lay out brilliantly the problems, but in fairness, which many don't, you also lay out brilliantly what we might do about it. So
I promise it's optimistic. Yeah. So and the essay is optimistic in some senses. So and this is, it partly goes to this question that I think that the way, as I said before, the way we talked about inequality was as this sort of trade-off. So that, a few different things were sort of implicit in our language about inequality. One was this trade-off that necessary evil, a more unequal society is less fair in some ways, but it is dynamic and there's an incentive effect and all the rest of it. And that was certainly the sort of 80s debate. And to some degree, that was, this is a bit kind of reductive, but that was the New Labour compromise, was to say we kind of buy that in some sense. We're comfortable with the filthy rich. They're part of the dynamic economy. We'll just do some redistribution. I'm mischaracterizing, but that notion of a trade-off was implicit. But also this point that you make about the way that translated into public policy was, you had a debate about efficiency on the one hand. So are markets efficient and are markets functioning well? Largely that was the job of economic regulators and departments like the Treasury and the Business Department to work through. And then you had a debate about equity, and that was separate, right? And that was, broadly speaking, again, this is a bit reductive, but this is essentially the way that people speak in Whitehall about, or spoke in Whitehall about these issues. The first goal was to make sure markets worked well and were competitive and were efficient. And then you came in and had a debate about equity, right? And that was largely a debate about redistribution, about, you know, DWP was the sort of home of that debate. And so, you know, they were sort of separate or separable as issues. And they genuinely were, so, or they were seen to be. So if you raised a question of equity in a roundtable, say, with a regulator, they'd sort of say, well, that's not really our job. That's for the politicians to think about. So, you know, this is a debate about efficiency. Equity's over there. I'm mischaracterizing a bit, but that was implicit, if not explicit, in a lot of the debate. Yeah. And I think one thing that has changed, and one way in which inequality is different, I mean, A, there's not that trade-off in the same way, because inequality is unfair and also sclerotic and not productive and not dynamic for all the reasons we've discussed. But also, I just don't think you can any longer have this idea that these two things are separable, because, you know, one of the things I say in the essay, that I think this is where a big opportunity lies. Why is inequality unproductive and sclerotic? It's those things because it's unfair, right? It's those things because, you know, lots of very talented people cannot access the good jobs, and they have lots of talents to offer to those jobs. Lots of very motivated and talented people cannot live near where the opportunities are. You know, lots of firms cannot hire people into the jobs that they need because there is not enough talent, because people cannot afford to live near those jobs or train to get the skills they need. And obviously it's not competitive, as we've said. So in a way, I think you can't any longer separate sort of, is the market working well, and then later we'll sort out some redistribution. It's all part of the same thing. And the way in which you have to make the market work better is by making it fairer and more inclusive, right? So it's a more integrated approach to the whole thing. And for me, there's quite a lot of political opportunity in that.
And in that sort of framing, James, again, in some respects, you know, you can think about the individual policies, which we'll come to in a second, but just in a kind of big picture, how do you think, does the role of the state need to, you know, to change and evolve in that context, in a sense that, and it's not just as simple, the state needs to be bigger or smaller, which is often where we end up, right? But we also hear the state needs to be more active or less active, you know, depending on who you're talking to from different, you know, philosophical kind of backgrounds, they'll have different views on this. But in your mind, given what you're talking about here, how do you see the role of the state as it is, but also how it might need to evolve in order to, you know, to take on that mantle of thinking about efficiency and equity together? There's an integrated response. You know, they might need to intervene in markets more than they typically or traditionally have. It's not all on the distribution side, let things rip and then just essentially tax a bit more and redistribute. It's more than that, right? But I mean, just how do you frame, what's the big picture for the role of the modern state in the modern economy?
I think, as you say, it's not, I think the big state, small state is for me always a red herring. I mean, I think it's all close to meaningless, the question of how big is the state. I mean, like, what is the state? I just like, where, I mean, I think the data shows that there's not much kind of meaning to that as a debate. I think the debate for me is more about, so what's the role of the state? And there's this quite nice phrase from the philosopher Roberto Unger, who has this kind of very sharp critique of social democracy as a kind of settlement, where he says it politics got reduced to sending checks in the mail, by which he means it was sort of compensatory, right? So we let these injustices play out, we let markets play out, and then we did some redistribution after the fact. So it was post hoc and it was compensatory. So we sort of said, you know, we have to live with these inequalities and injustices, and then we'll do a bit of tax and redistribution. For all the reasons discussed, I don't think you can conceive of the state's role in quite that way. And I do think, you know, maybe one word is a more activist state. So I just think you can't dodge these questions of competition policy, for example. You know, you just can't allow a situation to persist in which you have such scleroses in these markets and these massive, not least for the political consequences of power, where you have these massively dominant firms at the top, and then this very, very, very long tail of low productive firms. So I think you have to be more activist in that sense. Whether that's more interventionist, I'm not sure, because it's not so much for me about breaking up firms. It's about setting a different framework within which competition can function. Other areas I touch on, skills policy. I think you have to be just massively more radical in skills policy, because you know we have skills shortages, and we know that skills are still the route to mobility for many people, but people can't afford to invest in the skills that they need. Housing policy, I think you have to be just, again, dramatically more ambitious on house building and on planning reform, for example. So I guess these are areas where you're not sort of, yeah, you're not just kind of letting it all play out and then coming in afterwards and smoothing things over a bit.
Cleaning up, as it were, yeah. You're just letting it
happen.
Yeah,
you're being more upfront, right, and more... And you know, the phrase I have in the essay is that you make the economy more dynamic by making it more inclusive. And so it's this central point of the trade-off is not the trade-off that we once thought it was.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And as you say, you touched on some of them. In the five policies, at least, that you outline, and you recognize that, you know, there's more to come, or, you know, there's more thinking to be done. But, you know, the first one you talk about is kind of tackling the anti-competitive dynamics of digital, which is about competition policy, partly to do, can we reintroduce some of that disruption that we seem to have lost? How do we think about that? And that's not just breaking firms up, but it's actually allowing more activity, more firms to expand into those sorts of areas. Is that right?
Yeah, and there's a whole debate about this very live in big regulators. I mean, I gave a talk just this week to the Board of Competition Markets Authority, and yeah, to be fair, these big organizations are really thinking hard about this stuff. You know, questions on competition. Do you force the big tech platforms? The phrase I have in my book is, don't break them up, open them up. Seems to me, you know, do we really want another search engine in our lives? I'm not sure. I'm not sure we do, but I think, you know, force them to be interoperable, force them to open up their data for others to use, stop them being these private gardens where you can't move between these ecosystems and they can monopolize the data that they have. All of that, I think, makes for a more dynamic economy. So I think that's really a really important aspect of this. And it speaks to those cluster effects, right? You can't let them dominate and monopolize the power that they have. You have to open that up for others to use.
And part and parcel of that is your kind of second idea, which is about, you know, making sure that we encourage more experimentation, more business entrepreneurship, and we need to provide certain types of finance and funding into, so that more entrepreneurs can come forward and try stuff. And if it doesn't work, you know, you learn from it and you move on. And, you know, there is, as you say, when you look at the capital markets, or you look at sort of business financing, you know, debt and loan financing stuff is pretty, you know, it's pretty well spread across the country, but there is definitely concentrations. When you look at the you know, the venture capital end or the risk capital end, it tends to be concentrated in, you know, far fewer places. And actually loan and debt is not particularly good for business entrepreneurship in the early stages. I mean, that's the other thing.
Absolutely. And I mean, one of the most obnoxious phenomena in this whole thing is the friends and family round, right?
Yeah.
You know, as you say, debt finance is hardest to secure when you're running an intangible business, because what are you borrowing against? You don't have machinery and buildings, physical assets to borrow against. And so we've seen a move towards the equity finance away from debt finance and to this obnoxious idea of raising money from your friends and family for your startup, which is not accessible. And we know that, I mean, the numbers on venture capital, you know, going to men, you know, I mean, that proportion of women that get venture capital funding is a tiny, tiny fraction. So there's a homogeneity that comes from it. So yeah, making access to finance and entrepreneurialism more inclusive is, I think, at the heart of this.
Yeah. And another area which you've talked about throughout, so we'll skip it, but just to recognise, you know, that, you know, housing, as you say, housing comes very close nowadays to being a theory of everything, which I would definitely agree with. And, you know, you talked about you need to build much more housing, particularly in those more dynamic places, so they open up opportunity to a wider range of people. Your fourth area is adult skills, and you say, you know, adult skills policy needs to be taken out of the boring cupboard, which again I would agree with. But you also have a very specific thought around, and it borrows from the American post-war example of the GI Bill, which is essentially about providing quite large support for returning soldiers from the Second World War in order for them to acquire skills and to reintegrate themselves into the economy. So just say a little bit about your thinking on that, because I think that's a really neat idea.
Yeah, so this was in my book. I look at these nine big ideas for the future. And the one I got most excited about in writing it was, oddly, was skills policy, because it's the most boring. I'd say it's the most boring.
It's not boring, though, right? I mean,
it shouldn't be boring. It shouldn't be boring.
You think it's going to be boring, but then it's actually not.
I've been to so many roundtables on skills policy, and it's kind of like fiddling around these kind of incrementalist. I mean, it's complex. I mean, who the hell knows, you know, who's eligible for what? And I mean, it's a mess of a system. And for that reason, it gets cut very easily, because no one notices in terms of the wider public when skills policy, adult skills investment is cut. So it constantly gets cut back. And the story I sort of fell in love with was the story of the GI Bill in America, where, you know, in the just after the Second World War, there was a lot of fear in America about what would happen to the returning demobilized soldiers, because obviously there had been real difficulties after the First World War, and millions of soldiers were coming back. And so, somewhat by accident, there was this, you know, the GI Bill, which said we will fully fund university education, essentially, and really adequately fund, completely free. So, you know, it funded people to go to Harvard, it funded people to go to the best universities in America. I say by accident, because no one really anticipated what would happen. And the take up staggered everyone, for one thing. And what also staggered everyone was there was a lot of snobbery at the time that, you know, would these vets coming back, would they be able to cut it at these universities? Turns out they outperformed. They outperformed the other students. And there was this phrase, the vets got referred to as damned average raisers, because they worked so hard, they raised the average performance, and the other students had to work harder because these vets saw it as a once in a lifetime opportunity to get a free education. I just think it brings home how we've lost our ambition. You know, I did the numbers, and if you ran the GI Bill today in Britain at an equivalent scale for our population, it would mean fully funding 4 million adults to go to university for free. And so the scale of it, we need to find our ambition again on skills policy. The big takeaway from the GI Bill, yes, it changed lots of people's lives and it solved that problem of demobilization, but it also made it the American century, because it meant millions of Americans trained up in the skills of the future at the time, you know, industry, chemistry, and so on. And America then dominated those industries. So it was a massive economic success as well as a social success. So I take adult skills policy out of the boring cupboard and put some serious money into it.
Yeah, no, that I reading through them, I thought all five were very good. But that, I think that, and both in terms of the that you identified it and really emphasized it, but also the scale of ambition, which I think is definitely needed if we're going to make, you know, a material difference to some of the issues that you've highlighted. The fifth area you talk a little bit about is welfare, I guess, in two respects. Just get your thoughts on both. One is, you know, the sort of level of welfare, and obviously, you know, in a sense we're quite a stingy country, or very stingy country. If you're in work and fall out of work, you know, the wage substitution levels are very, very low, and I think that has a negative effect on the way that people can engage. But also, you talk about the way that people engage with the welfare system, and in a sense, the experience of welfare needs to be developed and improved as well. So just say a little bit about both of those.
So I think the debate, I mean, in a way, there's quite a crowded debate about the level of welfare, and don't disagree with that for a second. You know, it's clear that the adequacy of welfare levels in Britain has fallen to an unsustainably low level, as we see in the cost of living crisis. The piece, in a way, I'm more interested in is sort of thinking about a different role for welfare in these debates, because going back to that point, you know, in the old mental model, welfare was a compensation, essentially, was, you know, markets might lead to unequal outcomes, so let's do some smoothing out and compensating. As opposed to, I guess, the different way of thinking about welfare is as an enabler of participation, in the sense of, almost conceptually, welfare as a platform from which you can participate. And that is, it sort of starts to lean into the debates about universal basic income, just in the sense of, you know, everyone should have some kind of backstop that means they don't need to worry about where the next meal's coming from, and they don't need to live in a constant state of anxiety. But a lot of it is, some of that is about the level for sure. But a lot of that is about the experience. And so, you know, one thing I've, particularly in my years working at Citizens Advice, been struck by is the welfare system, just the experience of interacting with the welfare system. No one has any idea what they're going to be eligible for, given the complexity. No one has any idea if your income changes, if your earnings change, what will that do? And so people live in fear of moving jobs, which is precisely the kind of thing you want people to do, or changing their income or taking on more hours. And also it makes people feel crappy. I mean, you know, the experience of applying leaves people shot of all self-esteem and feeling like they're scrounging off of their fellow citizens. And that is not an empowering thing that makes people want to lean into the economy and participate and take risks, you know, kind of positive risks that you need people to take. So for me, it's about that reconceptualization is partly about the adequacy levels, but it's also about, I mean, I think I'm a bit of a convert on this, having been sort of skeptical at first, is moving towards a system that is simpler and more emphatically universal and just there for people in a way that it's not when you have to, you know, fill out endless forms, go through these kind of trials in terms of trying to clamber through the bureaucracy to apply, and is just sort of there for you in a way that enables you to take risks to participate in this economy.
Yeah, no, that's a very great point, and I would completely agree with that. To close, Jim, I suppose, where do you think, you know, you're proposing a new term, but what you're really proposing is a new way of thinking about, you know, some of these issues because of the nature of the way that the economy and society has kind of changed over the last year. What's your sense as to where do you think we are now in the reconceptualization of, you know, of the issues? And therefore, you know, I presumably you see that as the first step if we then want to devise sensible, you know, interventions or policies or support mechanisms in order to grapple with them. We need to understand actually what's happening and what that means. Where do you think we are? I guess, you know, in some areas it'll be much more, you know, you're much more advanced than other, you know, others, but just in a sort of a general policy stroke society level, where do you think we are?
I think we're quite early. I think you can see the signs. It's almost that we've got all the pieces in place. This is one reason I wrote the essay is I think this is happening quite a lot at the moment, I think, in public policy, that if you go looking, all of the pieces of quite a new way of thinking are there. So, you know, all I did really in this essay is just is piece together the work that's out there. There's fantastic work from the IFS, for example, on spatial inequality. There's great work on these questions of competition, a really interesting work going on housing, as you say, and increasingly people thinking about housing and the centrality of housing policy. So I think in some sense, all the pieces are there within sort of academia, the frontier of think tank work and academia. This is what one thing I tried to do and I'm trying to do is sort of frame that, package that together and tell a story about it to make sense of it. And then I do think it hasn't really percolated through into political narratives yet. I would say that I mean, really, when you hear politicians talking about inequality on both sides of politics, I would say actually those old ideas of that implicit trade-off of, you know, and the implicit separation between efficiency and equity, I think still run through the way politicians speak on the right and the left, maybe more so on the right. But in a way, I mean, maybe the sort of last point I make on that is I almost think the left will struggle with this almost more than people on the right, because in a way, inequality is such a kind of central concept to people on the left. It will be hard, I think, for progressives to sort of rethink it. And I think progressives feel very understandably quite attached to some of the ways of thinking about these issues from the 20th century, from bitter experience. And very, you know, obviously very, again, understandably in some ways, wedded to ideas of inequality as not much more than material distributions, wedded to concepts around redistribution being the central kind of mechanism that we use to combat inequality. So in, yeah, I think that that will be quite interesting to see how do progressives and people on the left grapple with this change in what is one of the most sort of dearly held concepts for progressive politics. And for me, a lot of the responsibility sits with the left as sort of the home of inequality, if you like, and the home of understanding and caring about inequality. And in a way, the kind of last point is, it's interesting when you look at the history of debate about inequality on the left, we used to have a broader set of conceptions of inequality. If you go back to the early 20th century, there was quite a rich and quite a broad palette of ways of thinking about inequality, from material distributions to relational inequality to, you know, different conceptions. And so I think in a way that we'll need to recapture that kind of broader set of narratives about inequality on the left, and much of the work is to be done there. And on the left of politics, I think a lot of the work sits there.
Yeah. And we've been talking about this essay, the third essay that you've penned as part of the project. Where just for listeners, where can they find, and we'll put a link to this essay, but where can they find the other essays, and obviously where can they find more writings, because you're writing constantly on these sorts of related issues, and obviously the book is there available as well. But you know, where can our listeners find your work to date?
Yeah, so the book is End State. My agent will kill me if I don't plug it. So End State, all good bookshops, Nine Ways Society is Broken and How We Can Fix It. It's optimistic, I promise. the writing, yeah, I mean, I write on Medium mostly, and I've got a Substack, so and on Twitter, although having had my Twitter account hacked recently, I'm trying to diversify away from Twitter. Got it back, luckily. But so yeah, Google my name, and Medium and Substack are the main places that I write, and that's where all these JRF essays were published. And thank you, I should say, to JRF for funding that series of essays. It was a pleasure to work with them on it.
Yeah, very good. And we'll put up links to the various essays and to the book and to your Substack and Medium as well when we put this up very shortly. But for now, James, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.